Chapter 4. What to do about work.
You survived the doctor's visits, the diagnosis, the prodding exams. You've made it through the loss and the grief and accepted that today, right now, you'll feel as good as you're going to feel. Now's the time to step out of survival mode and into living mode. In this and the next chapter, you'll discover how to do things you used to do, like resuming work and, yes, having fun.
Patricia Harriman has lived with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia for 14 years. During this time, she has suffered irritable bowel syndrome, panic attacks to the point of being homebound, dizzy spells which make it impossible for her to drive, and depression. Prior to getting sick, at age 37, she described herself as strong and energetic. "At first, I was so terribly sad," she recalls. "My life had been taken from me. I grieved for my old self. And then I learned to let go and accept. Just accept. It is what it is." From that place of acceptance, Harriman shaped a new life, not because she felt better, but because her illness brought a shift in her perspective. "I try to contribute something meaningful to every day. I picture each day as a canvas and my life as a palette of colors. I've learned to value the painting that emerges. I walk more slowly now and stop to notice the tiny details that make up the whole of life. The child playing marbles on the porch, the dog waiting for his master to come out of the store. At home, my backyard garden is blossoming and growing and reminds me that life comes in many forms. I have learned that my life is different than it used to be, but it is still my life, and I am truly grateful for it." When you're first diagnosed with a chronic illness, the last thing on your mind is creating a fulfilling life. Mere survival becomes your primary goal. For an initial shock phase, you're so caught up in the task of simply managing your emotions and the changes in your body and lifestyle, actually living seems out of the question. As time passes, you gain a level of acceptance and you realize, like Patricia Harriman, that you can go about living again. Life will be different, in some ways better, in some ways worse, but the bottom line is, it is a life. You still have gifts and talents. Spring continues to bless the earth each year, and the special people who selflessly love you still knock at your door. It is time to re-enter the world, to do the things that you used to do, whether it's going to the park with your kids, hanging out with your friends, or resuming your career. In the following pages, we'll talk about returning to work after an absence due to chronic illness, and what happens when you can't go back.
Let us realize that the privilege to work is a gift, that power to work is a blessing, that love of work is success. David O. McKay.
Returning to work. The emotions. Strap in for another turbulent ride. For those of you ready to dive back into your career, facing the workaday life can be at once joyous and frightening. On one hand, you may feel elation that you are well enough to get out. On the other, you're entering uncharted territory. How will I juggle my doctor appointments with my work schedule? What if I can't handle my job? How will my coworkers react to me? It's important to realize that this emotional pinball round is completely natural, and soon you'll regain your footing and fall into a new pattern of normal. Relief and inspiration. Yes, I can work. One of the hidden benefits of living with a chronic illness is that we get to appreciate, I mean really appreciate, what we have. I will never say, "I wish I didn't have to work," because I know how very blessed I am that I can work. I have experienced severe pain and symptoms that have kept me bedridden for weeks. During this time, every good day was precious. After one good day strung into the next, and I gained enough stamina to head back to work, the feeling I had was pure gratitude. Many of us find inspiration in our diseases as we return to the workplace. Audrey Cron, author of Meeting the Challenge, Living with Chronic Illness, writes, "Having Crohn's disease was an important part of why I became a psychotherapist. I went back to school so that I could work with people struggling with chronic illness. I've heard of others who became doctors, nurses, nutritionists, or sales representatives for drug companies." Joan Friedlander says her battle with Crohn's disease led her to shed a low-paying job and begin her practice as a career coach. "I was accepting employment situations that did not provide financial sufficiency and that were dead ends in terms of fulfilling my desire to more directly make a difference in the lives of others. I decided enough was enough. I declared I would find a job that would pay me what I was worth, one of the lessons I learned because of my illness. It takes a leap of faith to imagine that you can use illness and disease to inform you about what is not working for you in your life." Self-doubt. What if I don't make it? Positives are always tempered with negatives, and so it is when you return to work. Though you may feel relieved that you can work, you are likely riddled with self-doubt. What will my career look like now that I can't be at the office 50 hours a week? Will I advance? How will others perceive me? Here's some advice that will help you take the punch out of that nagging self-deprecation. Don't expect to go in at 100%. You'll end up beating yourself up if you set unrealistic expectations. I know it's hard to think otherwise, since the only marker you have is your performance prior to becoming ill, but please try. Take it slow. Do less than you think you can in the beginning, and incrementally ramp up to a level where you feel comfortable. Don't worry about the implications this will have on your career. Right now, it's more important for you to discover how much you are able to work so that you can properly gauge your capabilities in the future. Set your own limits. Communicate with your coworkers if you feel pressured to work to a level you aren't ready to handle. By setting realistic limits, you won't disappoint yourself or your colleagues. Realize your strengths and weaknesses. Work within your limits. If you have to stand several hours at a time on the job, for instance, and you are concerned you won't be able to anymore, talk to your employer to make adjustments. Play to your strengths, too. Let's say you are a lawyer. Your background is in litigation, but you know you are a skilled researcher. You are concerned that your body won't meet the physical demands of litigation, traveling, being on your feet for long stretches, strenuous interviews. Request that you be used as a researcher instead, a job where you can sit down and use your brain instead of your body. Remember, your health is priority one. The truth is, you may not be able to successfully resume your career. What's important is that you try. But don't push yourself at the expense of your health. Don't block that voice in your head that says, "I'm tired," or "that hurts." Above all, shut out the voice that says, "If you weren't such a weakling, you could finish this project." Such internal rumblings make you push past your breaking point, like you used to. The rules have changed, and you can't do that anymore. There is too much at stake, your health and your career. Communicate when you need help. Like most people, I get in over my head. It is not easy for me to say no because I get so enthusiastic about projects. As a result, I've found myself drowning. If you get into this situation, don't wait until the last minute to let someone know. Give the project back or ask for help, so your employer will have enough time to find the necessary resources to get the job done. Envy. Why is everyone else so lucky? When you hang out at the water cooler and discuss the weekend, you will hear stories of ski trips and late-night parties. I used to feel like an old curmudgeon when I'd hear about my coworkers' antics. Oh, to be healthy and free so I can run with the wind or ski down mountains. It's not easy to temper such pangs of jealousy. The truth is, my coworkers do get to frolic in their off time, while I'm at home recuperating from the work week. To envy, I say, don't waste your time. When you compare yourself to others, you are buying into the damaged goods syndrome. This practice is one of the single most destructive things you can do to your self-esteem. And for what? What is it buying you? Nothing but longing for a life that you don't know anything about and potentially isn't that great after all. Plenty of healthy people are miserable. Internal health leads to happiness. The beauty of this truth is that you will always have the ability to create a healthy inner you, no matter how ill your body becomes. Worry. What will they think? Whether they admit it or not, everyone worries about what other people think, especially when it comes to work. How can we avoid it when so much of our career success is based on the opinions of others, our employers, our key clients, and sometimes even our coworkers? The worry compounds when we have to ask for time off to manage our health. One way to avoid the worry is to keep your private life private. Your coworkers don't need to know where you are going in the middle of the afternoon. For all they know, you could have an important meeting with a client. As long as you are open with your direct superior about your whereabouts, keep everyone else in suspense. You don't need to explain yourself. Another way to temper anxiety is to remind yourself of this important message. It is none of your business what other people think. You can't control other people's opinions, but you can control yours. Stop thinking of yourself as damaged goods and start thinking of yourself as a viable asset to the workplace. If you know you are doing the best you can do, then who the heck cares what other people think? The naysayers will eventually wake up and see. Despite your unorthodox work schedule, you are a hard-working employee. Also helpful is to investigate the source of your worry so that you can root out the problem. I call this strategy, wait to worry. When you begin to fret, stop. First ask yourself, what's truly bothering me? Then, before you let yourself dive into a paralyzing panic session, see if there are some simple things you can do to alleviate the stress. Avoidance. I don't want to go. There will be mornings that you will want to hide under the covers. This is normal. Remember, even physically healthy people feel this way. When I have mornings like this, I employ the magic of acting as if. Once I get to work, I usually feel better. I also remind myself that after I get my brain moving in a work direction, it will stop focusing in the pain direction, which is always better for my psyche. But take heed. Be sure to check in with your body. If you want to stay under the covers because your body is displaying some new symptom or pain, take yourself to the doctor instead of work. Feeling trapped. I'll never be able to leave my job. What if you are returning to a job that you don't like? You need the money, and you need the insurance. You think, who's going to hire me now that I have an illness? I better stick with what I have. I understand this feeling. It's an issue I've had to cope with my entire career. But if I listened to the voice in my head that said I couldn't leave a job because of my condition, I wouldn't be writing this book today. For starters, lots of people will hire you despite your chronic illness. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, it's discriminatory for an employer not to hire you because of a health condition. I don't want to sound naive. Certainly there is discrimination in the world. But don't let fear of discrimination stop you from trying. In terms of insurance, despite recent reforms that I'll get into later, health insurance can certainly make chronically ill people feel trapped in their jobs, mainly because most U.S. citizens, 59.7% in the year 2006, says the U.S. Census Bureau, are covered through an employer. While a physically healthy person might be willing to take the risk and go without insurance as she job hunts or tries to contract work, a chronically ill person simply does not have that option. Getting individual insurance to fill the gap isn't always viable because the premiums can be outrageous, especially for patients with, I like to say, a colorful medical history. I understand why you'd want to throw up your hands and say, "It's not worth it, I'm never leaving my job." Though the temptation may be great, I urge you to instead zero in on getting unstuck. Devise a plan. You may have to return to a job you don't like to buy some time while you figure out what's next. Just giving yourself breathing room to dream a little will make you feel less trapped. Focus on what you are gaining. Remember that every job, even if you don't like it, is giving you valuable work skills. Get the facts. Research your insurance situation. Sometimes what you imagine is worse than what is. Can you buy your own insurance for a couple of months? How much will COBRA coverage cost? And how long will it protect you? Can you switch to your spouse's insurance? Once you get answers, you can make better decisions about your future. Dabble. Take a class or join a club in the career area that interests you. See if you really like it before taking the plunge. Dabbling will help you make strides toward your goal and build your resume at the same time. It also ensures you aren't falling victim to the old grass is greener syndrome.
Work is the true elixir of life. The busiest man is the happiest man. Sir Theodore Martin.
Returning to work. The facts. Learn your workplace rights. As you mesh your work life with your new life, get ready to face unfamiliar realities, such as working half-time because that's all your body can handle, requesting special accommodations, or dealing with coworkers' lack of understanding. You'll also hear yourself asking questions you never thought would come out of your mouth, like, "If I alter my work schedule to fit into my doctor's visits, can my boss demote me?" This new territory is unwelcome, often uncomfortable, and confusing to manage for everyone with a chronic illness, the seasoned vets and the just diagnosed alike. For starters, you need to be aware of the ADA. While specific questions should be addressed to an appropriate public or private counselor or attorney, some background facts about the ADA as it currently exists are important to know. The basics of the ADA. Under the ADA, employers cannot discriminate against people with disabilities and are required to make reasonable accommodations so the disabled can continue working. I suggest reading the ADA. A copy of this landmark legislation is available on the internet at the United States Department of Justice's website at www.usdoj.gov or at your local Social Security office. It's also wise to read your employee handbook to see what your company's policies are beyond the ADA. In the meantime, here's an overview of the legislation. What is disabled? A disability is a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more of your major life activities. Such activities include seeing, hearing, speaking, walking, breathing, performing manual tasks, learning, caring for oneself, and working. For instance, people with conditions like epilepsy, paralysis, AIDS, and individuals with substantial hearing or visual impairment are covered. What is discrimination? Discrimination means your employer is denying you equal jobs or benefits, is limiting your opportunities or status, or is not making reasonable accommodations because of your disability. A prospective employer is discriminating against you if he won't hire you because you are disabled. Under the ADA, your spouse or relatives can't be discriminated against because of your disability, and if anyone harasses you or retaliates against you for filing charges of discrimination, that's illegal. What is reasonable accommodation? Employers with 15 or more employees need to make the facilities their employees use accessible to people with disabilities. You can request that your employer restructure your job, modify your work schedule, or move you to a vacant position to accommodate your illness. If making such accommodations leads to undue hardship, in other words, it would seriously harm your employer or alter the nature of the business, he may be exempt. Hardship is reviewed on a case-by-case basis. So, how does all of this apply to chronic illness? Let me show you through a real-life example about a blind woman in Baltimore. She applied for a teaching position at an elementary school and, according to the woman, a representative at the Baltimore City Public School System, offered her a teaching position after two interviews during which she had used a cane. After she mentioned that she would soon be picking up her new service animal, she said the school's principal withdrew the offer rather than allow her to bring a dog in the building. The woman filed a complaint under the ADA through local channels, and the Department of Justice later filed a lawsuit. The court agreed the woman had been mistreated, and under the agreed consent decree, the school system will pay her $55,000, ensure that all personnel are trained in ADA law, and designate an employee to serve as the ADA coordinator. If you suspect your rights are being violated, you can file a claim. If you're thinking about filing a claim, be sure you document everything. Keep a detailed record of instances of discrimination, including all the parties who were involved, witnesses, dates, and times. The more hard information you have, the easier the process will be. Consult an attorney if you think you might have a claim, since certain time requirements may apply. When it comes to legal claims, delay can be disaster. Finding ADA resources. The ADA can be confusing, and hiring an attorney can be costly. If you need guidance, these groups can help. Patient Advocate Foundation. This nonprofit organization offers a wealth of information on the ADA and the FMLA, and also assists people in protecting their health insurance. The group puts out several useful brochures, including one that details both the ADA and the FMLA. You can read First My Illness, Now Job Discrimination, Steps to Resolution online at www.patientadvocate.org. Or you can order a free copy by dialing 800-532-5274. Independent Living Centers. Known as the Center for Independent Living, this organization helps people with disabilities live on their own through skills workshops, employment and housing services, legal advocacy, and other support programs. There are hundreds of these centers throughout the country. Look up your local office in the phone book. Or online for contact information, go to www.ilusa.com. Disability and Business Technical Assistance Centers. The purpose of these centers is to educate and train people on the ADA. They have a toll-free hotline at 800-949-4232. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This is a good place to gather basic facts about the ADA. You can find the website at www.eeoc.gov. or call 800-669-4000. Pick your battles. It's one thing to know your rights, it's another to exercise them. Pick your battles. Try out creative solutions to problems before throwing down the ADA card. If your employer is trying her best, by all means, work with her. To understand what I'm saying, listen to this story. Remember Byron Vuga, my friend with renal failure who biked across country? He approached me with a problem. Vuga was being dialyzed 3 times a week for 4 hours at a time. As a teacher, he was able to leave school at his last class and get to the dialysis unit in time for the final appointment. There, he would grade papers and plan his lessons. Everything was going like clockwork until the dialysis unit changed its hours, and the administrator told him he'd have to show up earlier. When Vuga explained that he couldn't leave school, she suggested he ask for reasonable accommodation. He said to me, "Yeah, sure, I can ask for reasonable accommodation, and the school will have to comply, but the reality is I may not continue to advance in my career. If I leave early 3 times a week, that would not be a good thing." I hate to say it, but I agreed with him. Regardless of what his school would actually do, I didn't think Vuga should take such a chance at this young stage of his career. I suggested he find another dialysis unit, one that would offer treatment schedules before and after work hours. Shortly thereafter, Vuga received a transplant, so he never had to face the dilemma. Had he asked for reasonable accommodation, he would have benefited in the short term, but in the long term, I wonder if he would have lost out. The basics of the FMLA. The FMLA is important to know about when you need to take large chunks of time off, or if you need to cut back your hourly or weekly schedule. It entitles eligible employees to take 12 weeks of unpaid, job-protected leave per year for family and medical reasons. The FMLA applies to employers and public agencies that employ 50 or more employees. To be eligible for the FMLA under current law, you must have worked for a U.S.-based employer for a total of 12 months. During that time, you had to have worked for at least 1,250 hours. FMLA benefits. Leave. You are allowed off 12 unpaid work weeks during a 1-year period for a variety of reasons, one of which is a serious health condition. You may schedule your leave intermittently, meaning you can take blocks of time off, or adjust your daily or weekly hours to accommodate your situation. Health insurance protection. When you take leave under the FMLA, your employer is not allowed to stop your health benefits. Job protection. When you return to work, you must be restored to your original or an equivalent job with the same pay and benefits. If it hasn't already, you can see how the FMLA might come in handy for you. If you need to take 2 months off for surgery, for instance, or if you are suddenly admitted to the hospital and you discover you won't be coming back to work for a month, you won't have to worry about suddenly getting the axe at work or losing your health benefits. Issues at work. Now that we've covered the ADA and FMLA, let's get into a few of the issues that may come up for you at work. Should I tell my boss I have an illness? According to the federal government, you don't have a duty to tell an employer about your condition unless it will impede your ability to perform your job. I'm not against disclosing your condition to a supervisor, but I suggest that you do it on a need-to-know basis. Wait until you feel it's necessary to tell your boss. For instance, if you need to take time off. If you say too much too soon, your supervisor may prejudge the kind of work you are able to do, or may withhold projects, thinking she's doing you a favor. Let your employer judge you on your work alone, not a potential future bout you may have with an illness. Should I tell my coworkers I have an illness? There are compelling arguments on both sides. Keeping your illness to yourself, if you can, tends to keep things simple. When employees disclose their health status to peers, a complex work environment can evolve. According to Norma Jean Vescovo, the executive director of the Independent Living Center of Southern California. I have found employees who reveal their disability to coworkers tend to get more assistance than they need. These employees have to make sure to keep their position whole. They should not expect to be treated differently. Vescovo says the coworkers may overextend their help and then take credit for the work the ill person should have been doing. Such a dynamic will undermine the chronically ill person's position at work, which can be an unhealthy environment for everyone. That said, more often than not, my coworkers have known about my kidney disease. This is partly because, for me, the line between coworker and friend is often quite blurry, and partly because circumstances, like needing to take a leave for surgery, often made it clear to everyone I had a unique health situation. I'm also an open person, and it's natural for me to tell people about myself. I think it helps people to relate to me better and sets them at ease. It's up to you to assess yourself, your office environment, and your relationships with coworkers to determine if disclosure is the best path for you. In any case, I suggest you save the gory details about your appointments, symptoms, and how bad you feel for your support group. If you tell your coworkers too much, you run the risk of scaring them off, appearing like a whiner, or having them judge you based on your illness versus your performance at work. What if my job duties become too strenuous? If you can no longer work in your field, speak to your boss or human resources manager about transferring to a less strenuous job or adjusting your schedule. Be open to creative solutions. One option gaining ground in many companies is job sharing, where two people share the duties of one full-time job. They work out the details of the schedule themselves. This is a great idea for people who are on dialysis 3 times a week or balance a heavy treatment schedule. If your employer doesn't have an alternative schedule or position for you, talk to the EEOC, a social worker, or someone knowledgeable about the ADA, and ask them to advise you about your best course of action. Whatever you do, don't quit. You can use the law to insist that your current employer accommodate you. However, if you quit voluntarily, it can be much more difficult to force a previous employer to hire you back and come into compliance with the law. Coping with coworkers' prejudice. As people find out about your illness, either through word of mouth or because it is visibly apparent, their reactions will vary widely. Some will react naturally. Some will be overly sympathetic. Some will avoid you, and some will lash out with discriminatory behavior. I wish I could say you will never encounter prejudice, but I'd be lying. Discrimination can be as simple as being excluded from the office social life, or as overt as being rejected for a promotion because you look or sound different. Rhonda Brooks, who has lived with renal disease for 12 years, believes prejudice kept her from getting a job as a controller. She tells about the time she was passed up for the position. I was in the final stages of the interview process. This was the last interview before they made a hiring decision. It was down to me and one other person. One of the VPs noticed I had a gap in work history and was curious how I supported myself. I replied, "I attended college for 4 years." I was trying to get around the question. He was insistent, and I told him, "I left my previous job and took long-term disability because I had kidney problems. I ended up on dialysis, and now I have a successful transplant. I can do the job, and I have no health difficulties. I even completed my degree while on dialysis." In an instant, his attitude changed from positive and happy to stunned silence. Up until that point, I was the top candidate. Needless to say, I didn't get the job. I believe prejudice is rooted in a lack of understanding. How you cope with it depends on what type of person you are and what kind of discrimination you are experiencing. In terms of the more subtle forms of bias, such as exclusion and gossip, I've found the best approach is to befriend my coworkers. This helps in two ways. One, it lets them know me, which educates them about my condition. The more they understand me, the less likely they are to draw prejudicial conclusions. The other benefit of becoming pals with coworkers is, when I sense tension, it's easier for me to open a discussion and find out what's really going on. By communicating directly, I nip any behind-my-face chatter in the bud. When you are met with more extreme forms of discrimination, things get more complicated. My main advice is, don't ignore it. If you are being bothered at work, talk to your supervisor, human resources manager, or seek counsel from one of the many organizations designed to aid people in such situations. Discrimination is extremely difficult to look in the face. When it happens to you, I know it can be devastating. The key here is to point it out, and don't let it knock you down permanently. For every ignorant person who spreads hate, ignorance, or stereotypes, there are many others who will see and appreciate you as you are. ABCs of Insurance. I include insurance in this chapter on work because so many Americans are insured through their jobs. The two are often inexorably linked. We've already discussed how the insurance burden may make you feel trapped in your position. Now let's dig a little deeper. There are several types of insurance for which you can apply. The most common is group coverage, provided through an employer. You may also opt for individual, but the premiums can be extremely high. Social Security Disability Insurance, which encompasses Medicare and Medicaid, is reserved primarily for the elderly, disabled, low-income, and unemployed. In a pinch, there is also COBRA. Current COBRA requires employers to let you continue group coverage for typically 18 months after you've left your job. While COBRA helps temporarily, it's a short-term fix, and the monthly premiums can be exorbitant. Judging by this quick synopsis, our insurance options are limited, especially when compared to Britain or Canada's federally sponsored programs. But at least we have options. Prior to 1996, when Congress enacted the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, people with chronic illness could get denied health benefits all too easily. HIPAA limits an insurer's ability to deny you coverage due to pre-existing conditions, and it makes it illegal for group health plans to discriminate based on your or your family members' medical histories. Before the HIPAA, if your employer changed carriers or if you switched jobs and signed up for new health insurance, the new insurer could refuse to accept you. While the law is an improvement, there are still concerns, according to a March 2000 report by the Syracuse University's Center for Policy Research. The researchers found that, despite the HIPAA, serious or chronic illness might continue to adversely affect the adequacy of coverage, and additional health insurance reform may be warranted. Chronically ill patients still have to deal with caps on lifetime payouts for certain illnesses. Further, the HIPAA does not limit the amount you can be charged for the policy, and there is evidence that the insurers are responding to HIPAA with higher-cost health insurance and even avoiding statutory requirements in some cases. That said, the law does prevent employee-sponsored insurers from charging one individual a higher premium based on that individual's health status. For example, if you have diabetes, you cannot be charged a higher premium because of that medical condition. An individual must be charged the same premium as similarly situated individuals. Similarly situated individuals are, for example, other people in the same employee category or geographic location as you. When something goes wrong. What can you do when you feel you've been unjustly treated by an insurance carrier? If you pay all or part of your premium, call the insurance company directly. Ask for your claim to be reviewed and a report sent back to you. If your company pays your premium, contact your supervisor or employee benefits administrator. From what I have heard, many companies are afraid to rock the boat with their health insurance carriers for fear of their rates being raised. Don't despair and be persistent. Keep copies of all claims and document all your conversations, including the date, time, name, and phone number of the person you contacted. If the review doesn't go your way, contact your state insurance commission for help. Still no action? Seek legal counsel promptly to avoid missing any deadlines. In general, you should become aware of applicable legal deadlines before you start.
Results? Why, man, I have gotten lots of results. I know several thousand things that won't work. Thomas Edison.
Hire me. Job hunting with a chronic illness. Looking for a job can be brutal. It wears away at everyone's self-esteem, but can be especially difficult for people who already have a touch of the damaged goods syndrome. When you start feeling less than during your job search, remember the words of Malia Langdon, a young woman wise beyond her years. Langdon had kidney failure in her teens, and since then, she has had to regularly dialyze and has had several surgeries. Despite these barriers, in May 2001, she graduated with a master's degree in fine arts. But like many recent graduates, she had no clue what she wanted to do next. However, she wasn't letting that get her down. Dealing with serious health issues at an early age has helped me to gain perspective, she explained. When my peers were stressing out over grades or what college they would get into, I was simply thankful that my health was well. This is something of which I constantly have to remind myself. When I am discouraged over career issues, insignificant or material things, I must remember to be thankful that I have the energy and the good health to be able to pursue these things in the first place. Molly is now transplanted, and her positive attitude paid off. She works for CBS Studios in comedy development. Researching a new field and getting connected. If you are switching careers, I suggest you do some deep research on the field before sending out a single resume. Because of our dependence on health benefits and our special requirements in the workplace, changing jobs is a few degrees riskier for us than the average person. It is important that you make sure you are committed to your new endeavor before you quit what you have. The following suggestions will help you get the information you need. Most are also great ways to make contacts and gain skills if you are re-entering the job market after a long absence. Attend conferences and seminars. Conferences are great because they show you a microcosm of your field of interest. In one weekend, you can learn just about everything you need to know. What are the people like? What is the industry culture like? What are the big issues? They are also excellent for contacts and to prepare you for an upcoming interview. Enroll in a local college class. A high-level class is an excellent way to see if you are interested in a new field. Whether you realize it or not, classes give you practical experience. If you participated in a group research project in your Social Behavior of Dolphins class, for example, you can talk about the results in your upcoming interview with the Maritime Lab. I suggest you get to know your professor, who could be a contact or reference when you are ready to begin interviewing. Interview. Accept every opportunity to interview, even if you don't think you want the job. You can tell a lot about a company, the culture, the people, the type of work you will perform, when you interview. An interview can be a first-hand education on both the company and the field as a whole. The other benefit? The more interviews you go on, the better you'll get. Since living with a chronic illness often damages your confidence, it's very important to practice, practice, practice. Internships. If you have the time and the ability to work for little or no pay, do an internship. You'll get on-the-job training without a long-term commitment. You'll be able to see if this is the kind of work you could do for the next few years, not to mention the fact that internships often lead to jobs. Volunteer. Like an internship, volunteering is a hands-on way to discover whether you'll like a new field. It's also a great way to build connections you'll need if you are switching fields or are re-entering the workplace. At one point in my career, I was working at Disney when all I really wanted was to work in the renal care industry and help other patients. That's when I decided that if I didn't have enough experience to get paid, perhaps I could offer my enthusiasm for free to get the experience I needed. I joined renal patient services committees and started meeting people. Ultimately, I earned a seat on the patient advisory committee for the Southern California Renal Disease Council. The council sent me to a meeting in Florida as its representative. Impressed by my passion for the cause, the owner of a renal care company offered me a job on the spot. That was my start working in the field I love. If you're long on enthusiasm and short on resume, volunteering is the way to go. The Interview Balancing Act: What to Reveal or Conceal. You have a hot lead on the dream job. Now, if you could just get past the interview. Interviewing is hard for everybody, but it's especially difficult for people with chronic illness. For one, you may have visible signs of your condition. Also, sticky questions can surface about whether you are capable. Following are some tips to help you paddle through the murky waters. Know how much you should say about your illness. There are legal protections in place so you won't be discriminated against as you interview. Be aware that a potential employer is not allowed to ask you about your disability. She can ask, however, about your ability to perform job functions. Also, she can condition her job offer on the result of a job-related medical exam, but only if the same test is required for all entering employees in the same job category. Be ready for questions about gaps in your employment. To fill in those untidy gaps on your resume, you may want to discuss volunteer service and/or schooling, especially if it relates to the job for which you were applying. For instance, let's say you had to stop working because you needed a series of operations. During your recovery time between procedures, you volunteered for a nonprofit group and gave speeches to youth groups. You could tell the interviewer something like, "After I left my job at ABC Company in 1994, I volunteered at XYZ Help the Kids. There I honed my speaking skills, which would be an asset to your company." That way, you will truthfully account for the gaps in your employment while promoting your candidacy for the job, without disclosing more information than the interviewer is entitled to know. Don't try to hide your disability. If your disability is noticeable, the best solution is to disarm people by being honest and confident about it. Don't try to hide it. Address it if it seems appropriate. If I am out to lunch with a prospective client, for instance, my knees creak when I get up from the table. I don't make a big deal out of it, but I do say, "Excuse me, I'm a little stiff today." I acknowledge my disability, but I also make the other person feel at ease by showing them that I am able to manage it. How you respond to the comments and looks during the interview makes all the difference. If you have shame about your illness, it will project and make people feel uncomfortable. Conversely, if you are proud of who you are, your confidence will shine through, like magic. Take steps now to avoid problems in the future. Whether drastic or simple, I suggest you take the initiative to make job-related changes on your terms, rather than waiting until, God forbid, your illness takes over and you are left without choices. Taking charge means sitting down and looking at the long-term impact of your chronic illness. How much longer will you be able to work? Do you foresee changes in your body that will hinder your ability to do your present job? What can you do to protect yourself should these changes surface? I don't believe that making a backup plan constitutes negative thinking, nor do I view such forethought as a pessimistic approach to living with a chronic illness. In fact, I think everyone, regardless of health, should have a plan B. It just makes good sense. Anthony Tussler, who has lived with a spinal cord injury since he was 5 years old, knows about planning for the future. Although he works as a technology consultant in the disability field, Tussler knows from literature that people with spinal cord injuries tend to lose much of their stamina as they age. Tussler also fears that the tendonitis in his shoulder, which he's developed from pushing his wheelchair, may get worse. As a result, Tussler has purchased an electric wheelchair and makes sure to reserve one whenever he travels to conferences.
I always have to plan ahead whenever I go to a new place. I can't assume that I can get to the same places as everyone else, he explains. I need to always be looking for the accessible entrance, the curb cut, and the easy-to-open door. When I'm traveling on business or pleasure, planning ahead and being willing to change my plans is essential.
Tussler also carefully balances his workload so he doesn't take on too much, and he's prepared to use his Social Security disability pensions when working becomes too much. In my case, as I've mentioned before, my knees are not as strong as I wish they were. Sometimes they cause me pain and prevent me from walking or standing as long as I'd like. Given the fact that living with a transplanted kidney means I will continue taking steroids and immunosuppressant drugs for the rest of my life, or for the life of the organ, there is a good chance that my knee joints will always be problematic. I must face the fact that there might come a time when I won't be able to get out and travel for business the way I do today. Therefore, I am learning as much about the computer as I possibly can so I can continue to be productive and support myself from home. On a more emotional level, I am preparing myself for that one day when I may need to sit rather than stand while giving an hour-long speech. What's your plan B? Giving up your career when work isn't an option. Meaningful work helps meet that need we all have to make a difference, however big or small. Sick or healthy, we all need to be needed. For many, especially those who are single or without children, having a satisfying career helps scratch that itch for significance. Also, having a job often provides a much-needed diversion from the daily grind of living with ongoing medical concerns. But what if that thing that gives you an alternate focus is taken away from you? Greg Falconer was faced with just this situation. After being diagnosed with kidney failure at age 22, Falconer was forced to leave a job he enjoyed as an assistant parts manager at a car dealership. It was apparent I could not go back to work. Some of it was physical, and there were obstacles related to obtaining health insurance. The fact is, they didn't want to insure me, he explains. Falconer says at first he worried about not contributing financially and that he would be unhappy without a professional outlet.
I'm the type of person who's always doing something. I'm not very sedentary. I grew up in a time when guys ask you what you do, and what they're asking is, where do you work?
Falconer found a solution when his wife, Cheryl, had baby Carolyn.
I became a stay-at-home dad, managing all the household chores, Falconer recalled.
That was back in 1977.
Today, my wife and I adopted a little boy named Chance, and I have an opportunity at parenting all over again. Being a full-time dad is one of the most gratifying things I have ever done. People ask me if I work, and I say, yes, I work every day. I just don't get paid. For Falconer, the end of his career didn't mean the end of the world. In fact, it meant the beginning of a new life, one that Falconer found just as fulfilling. Like Falconer, you can find things to do outside of your former career. Look at your list of things you can do from the first toolbox exercise, and one by one, start doing them. You never know, you may tap into a whole new passion.
No work means no money. What am I going to do? It's the classic 1-2 punch. First, you get knocked down by a chronic illness. Then, as you're flat on your back, you have to give up your job. Now, you don't have insurance, but you still need medical care. The bills are piling up, and you don't have any way to pay them. Hopefully, this scary scenario isn't one you'll have to face. If you do, however, there are resources. You just need to know where to look. Patient Advocate Foundation. This is a great place to start. The nonprofit group puts out the National Financial Resource Guidebook for Patients, which breaks down the options available to patients who need financial relief for stresses like housing, food, transportation, childcare, and insurance deductibles. The resources are listed on a state-by-state basis, which makes it easy to track down help in your specific region. The guidebook is searchable online at www.patientadvocate.org, or you can call 800-532-5274 to order a paper copy. The foundation will send you your state's listings at no charge, or you can purchase the entire book. Protection and Advocacy Systems, also known as PNAs, these federally mandated disability rights agencies are all over the country. You'll have to look in the government pages in your phone book to locate the one nearest you, or you can search online at www.napas.org. PNA agencies provide legal representation and other advocacy services to people with disabilities. In addition to monitoring conditions and facilities that care for disabled people, PNAs make sure individuals with disabilities get full access to educational programs, financial entitlements, health care, accessible housing, and employment opportunities. State Rehabilitation Centers. Every state offers vocational rehabilitation services. You'll have to look in the phone book for your state's agency. Each one is called something slightly different. The goal of such organizations is to help individuals with disabilities get and keep jobs. Although you are not able to work right now, hooking up with such a center may help you explore your options, and you may be surprised at the scope of its offerings. In addition to job search and placement help, most rehab places offer counseling and guidance, diagnosis, and some treatment of physical and mental impairments, some transportation, on-the-job or personal assistance services, and referrals so you can get help from other government entities. Turning to the Social Security Administration. Another place to turn for help is the Social Security Administration. This federal government agency has two programs that pay benefits to people with disabilities: Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI, and Supplemental Security Income, SSI. Both are reserved for people who are unable to work, though you may be able to make a little bit of money and still receive some benefits. The more money you make, the fewer benefits you receive. SSDI is for individuals who paid into Social Security via taxes before they stopped working. SSI pays benefits based on a financial need. Many people who are on SSI get food stamps and Medicaid, which helps pay doctor and hospital bills. I have been on SSDI and am grateful that it was there when I needed it. But there is a price to pay for receiving benefits. You have very little money, meaning you live month to month with the specter of what if they cut me off hanging over your head. Also, it can be difficult to qualify for SSDI. You have to prove that you are too sick to do just about anything, and this isn't always easy. Several chronic illnesses, like chronic fatigue syndrome, are not diagnosed based on a conclusive set of tests. Rather, diagnoses are made based on the opinion of your doctor, which won't always carry the weight needed to qualify for Social Security. Applicants may need to see several doctors and submit multiple appeals before being accepted into the program, a process that could take years. In fact, 85% of SSDI claims are denied at the first level, and 75% are denied at the appeal level, according to the Employees Advocacy Group, a company that helps process SSDI claims. Applying for SSDI. The first step in applying for SSDI is to visit the Social Security Administration's website at www.ssa.gov. Or contact local office by calling 800-772-1213. The representative there will walk you through the steps and explain what forms you need to fill out and the type of documentation, which is ample, you will need to provide. If you do use SSDI, do not become complacent. Beware of getting caught in the rut of adapting your lifestyle to the meager government allotment. As I described earlier, there are many services available for people who live with a disability, ranging from vocational rehabilitation to educational advancement. If you are well enough, take advantage. Even if you can't work regularly, if you sharpen your skills during the times you are able, when opportunity strikes, you will be ready.
Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Helen Keller.
You always have options. Do your part to keep them intact. I would be lying if I said this whole work thing were easy. From getting insurance to the frustrating hoops we have to jump through for aid from our government, the issues surrounding employment can be incredibly difficult. When you get discouraged, remember, you always have options. If you are healthy enough to work, too sick to get out of bed, or somewhere in between, there is a resource out there, somewhere that can reassuringly place you on a path to an easier life. We live in a privileged country where we have access to just about anything we desire. Think about people who live in countries that lack the most basic health care, social services, and employment opportunities. How would it feel to have nowhere to turn? I know we each have hurdles to climb, but at least we are able to anticipate something better on the other side. I encourage you to honor this fact by doing your part to keep our system moving in a positive direction. Get involved to help educate the public and our elected officials about chronic illness. If you take that first step, you never know what might happen. I applied to California Governor Gray Davis for an appointment on the State Rehabilitation Council. After sending in my paperwork, I wasn't hopeful. I didn't have any political connections, nor had I served on any prominent commissions. But then, lo and behold, I got a call from Governor Davis's appointment secretary telling me I was in. I served on the council, making friends, learning new things, and most importantly, sharing my ideas to help make the system better. My guess is you have a treasure chest full of great ideas, too. As you re-enter the world, think about this. What can you do to get them heard? Don't quit. I have a few words of advice for those recently diagnosed. Don't quit your job. That is, unless your physician advises you to do so. I have met many people in the beginning stages of illness who are dealing with so much physical pain, raw emotion, medical tests, and doctor appointments that they say, to heck with it, I can't even think about work. Look into all your options before taking this drastic measure. Talk with your employer about what's going on. Talk to your physician. See if you can take an extended leave, adjust your hours, or switch to more manageable responsibilities. Know your legal rights under the Family Medical Leave Act, FMLA, which offers unpaid leave and other protections in many cases. Many employers have even more liberal policies than provided by law, so investigate your employer's policies. If you quit your job, You may be adding more stress in your life than you intended to take away. You may be jeopardizing your insurance, and you will be eliminating a future source of income when your health improves. If you own your own business, have a discussion with your physician about how your illness is likely to affect your productivity, become familiar with your disability coverage, and work your illness into your business plans. Beware of overcompensation. Earlier in my career, I would give 150% to my employer. I often felt desperate. I couldn't afford to lose a job because of health insurance. I felt I was in more jeopardy of getting the axe than the average person because of my health issues. If I proved myself when I was well, I reasoned, then when I had to take work off, my employer would be less likely to get rid of me. The result? I overcompensated. I did way more than was necessary to get the job done. I put in lots of overtime and ran myself ragged. I simply didn't have a full sense of who I was, and that giving 100% was enough. I have since come to understand my tendency to overdo it, and can now counter the negative self-talk with truthful reminders. Giving a solid day's work is sufficient. If it's not, the issue is with my employer and not me. Wait to worry. Before you let worrying about a problem about work stunt you, see if there's something you can do to solve it. The worry? Too much to do. Make a to-do list. Seeing it on paper will help you plan your time. Get organized. Buy a Palm Pilot, day timer, or other personal assistant tool. Fretting about missing appointments is a total waste of time. Don't procrastinate. Procrastination leads to worry. Just get the task done so you can cross it off your list and move on to the next item. Pare down. You may have too much going on. Look at your life and see where you can simplify. Ask your employer to lighten your workload. The worry? Coworker conflict. Go to the source. Nothing is more stressful than personality conflicts at work. Such a problem can make it difficult to get your job done. I've found the very best way to solve these kinds of issues is to go to the source. Don't complain to your friends. Go to the person you are having difficulties with and hash it out with him or her. The worry? General anxiety. Talk to a good friend. Even if you don't know what's upsetting you, a good friend or counselor can have just the magic words to make you realize the source of your anxiety. A new perspective might offer new solutions. Check in with your body. Are you taking care of yourself? Are you exercising and eating a balanced diet? How are your meds? Do they need adjustment? Could they be causing emotional strain? The worry? Job dissatisfaction. Talk to the problem solver. So often we go to every Tom, Dick, and Harry with our woes when it's really Susan who has the problem-solving power. If you're unhappy with a situation at work, go straight to the person who can make a meaningful change. For love or health insurance. Note. A number of years ago, I wrote a humorous piece for a kidney disease newsletter that poked fun at the insurance issue. This was before the passage of legislative reforms, when the situation was even more dire than it is today. Here is a pared-down version of it, just for laughs. So often you hear romantics bemoan, "Oh, what we do for love." Their list of antics may include buying an expensive box of chocolates, wooing their love over a candlelight dinner, or tossing a dangerously flirtatious glance across the room. People living with chronic illness have a similar phrase, "What we do for health insurance." But the things we do aren't nearly as cute. Instead, our tactics look something like this. Forget about the sweet guy I madly love. He doesn't have health coverage.
I'm more interested in the grumpy old guy over there leaning on his Mercedes. Surely I can get on his policy. Yes, we do crazy things for health insurance. We stay in miserable relationships and miserable jobs rather than giving up our benefits. We get on long waiting lists for high-risk plans, and we're thrilled when we're accepted, even though we're paying obnoxious premiums. One day, a friend of mine faxed me an ad. It read, "Your pre-existing condition just became medical history." A glimmer of hope. Surely we're on to something, I thought. I dialed the number and quickly realized getting through their phone system was part of their pre-qualifying test. First, they judged my mental competency by asking me to navigate an amazingly complicated phone tree. I failed. I finally pushed the right number after 5 repeats of the menu. Then they examined my physical stamina by leaving me on hold for what seemed an eternity. Finally, a very nice lady answered and asked how she could help me. "I would like to know if you would insure me," I said. "I had a kidney transplant and have no sign of complications." Without skipping a beat, she said, "Oh no, we don't take your disease." "Well, what is this pre-existing ad all about?" I shot back. "There are a few pre-existing conditions we're accepting, just not yours," she replied. I asked to see the list. I wanted to find out if hangnails or split ends were on it. I thanked her and hung up. Today, I am fortunate enough to have a health insurance plan through my husband's work. And no, I didn't marry him just for his insurance, but it was a nice fringe benefit. Still, I went without insurance for a while, and I know how frightening it can be. I hope our government addresses these issues and comes through with a solid plan for all people to have access to affordable health care. For myself, I'd like to go back to the old days when a night out with my friends meant discussing what we do for love instead of what we do for health insurance. Juggling work and medical appointments. Taking care of yourself with an illness can be, in itself, a full-time job. So how do you blend your work schedule with your medical schedule and stay sane in the process? Book your appointment at the end of the day. That way, you don't have to return to work after the visit. This eases running around and allows you to take less time off since you don't have to waste the minutes commuting back to the office. Book appointments far in advance. If your appointments are routine, book them as far ahead as possible to ensure that you'll get the time slot you need. Get to know the front office people. Tell them about your tight schedule and ask them to do their best to work around it. Remember, you are the customer. Tie up loose ends before you leave work. If you are able, schedule appointments at the end point of projects so you know things will be sewn up before you leave. If you aren't needed while you are gone, your absence will be less remarked upon. Communicate. Don't be ashamed to leave the office for a couple of hours. You have the right to take care of your health. If you act sorry or sneak out of work, it will most likely make other people think you are doing something sneaky, such as interviewing for another job. If you are upfront and don't make excuses on your way out the door, your coworkers will be more likely to accept your early departures. Of course I've been to surgery. When I was working as a sales manager for a catheter company, one of my jobs was to serve as backup for the sales reps who would accompany doctors into surgery to instruct them on proper placement of the product. Prior to surgery, I was waiting in the doctor's lounge chatting with some of the nurses who knew my background. They asked me about my transplant. The doctor overheard this conversation but didn't say anything. Later, during surgery, he asked in disbelief, "So, you're a transplant patient?" "Yes," I said. "And you're a manager?" "Yes," I said. Clearly, he was struggling with the idea that I could be a transplant patient and handle a demanding position. "Really? How did you get this job?" he asked. In the interview, they asked me if I'd ever been to surgery, I explained. I answered, 34 times. They just didn't ask me if I was awake. Do's and don'ts to protect your coverage. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, available at www.cms.hhs.gov, suggests taking the following precautions when changing your job or insurance provider. Do ask for a certificate of creditable coverage. Such a certificate shows how long you have had health coverage. This can be important when you enroll in a new group health plan or get individual coverage. Do consider accepting continuation coverage. If COBRA, temporary continuation of coverage, or state continuation coverage is available and offered to you, you should seriously consider accepting it. If you do not accept and exhaust the coverage, you may lose some of your HIPAA rights and protections. Don't allow a break in coverage. If you wait 63 or more full days in a row to get health coverage, you will not get credit for your previous coverage, and you might lose some of your HIPAA rights and protections. Do be cautious when converting coverage. Some insurance issuers offer the chance to convert from a group health plan to an individual policy. This means that you would still have a policy with the same issuer, but it would be an individual policy. The benefits may not be the same, and generally the premiums would be more expensive. It is important to remember that if you accept a conversion policy, you may not be HIPAA eligible for individual coverage after the conversion policy ends. Do shop around. Different people will have different options when losing or changing health coverage. Be sure you research your options and know your rights. Lori's Toolbox 8. Lori's How to Wow Guidebook. Use these chronically happy tips for the interview. The old damaged goods mentality tends to resurface when we put ourselves on the line, and we are never more on the line than when we interview for a job, especially if it's a position we really want. Don't despair. Dig into your toolbox and find your How to Wow guidebook, and the job will be yours. As you go through this exercise, fight the temptation to listen to the negative voice that says you are a less desirable candidate because of your illness. You are as skilled as the next guy. All you have to do is prepare, 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 and your interviewer will see your value too. Write out questions and answers. If you are able to anticipate your interviewer's questions, you'll avoid being caught off guard, which makes all of us stumble. I'm not suggesting canned answers. I am suggesting that you carefully think through and write down what you'll say to the basics. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? What are your career goals? And what is your greatest weakness? Watch yourself. Videotape yourself and have a loved one critique you. With brutal honesty. Learn speaking techniques. I joined Toastmasters to improve my public speaking ability, but the skills I learned there also greatly helped me with my interviewing skills. Toastmasters or a public speaking class could be useful for you, too, especially if you have a fear of interviewing or speaking in front of groups of people. Do mock interviews. Work on presenting yourself with poise and confidence. And once again, know your rights by reading up on the ADA. Avoid walking into an interview with a shamed look that pleads, "Please hire me. I'm sick, and I really need the money." You may have an illness, but you haven't lost your ability to work hard and to be responsible, resourceful, and creative. It's all still there. What more could an employer want?